All right, welcome back to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. And happy New Year to everybody. Sorry for the long hiatus, but there were holidays. This time, me and Christian. Hello there, Christian.
Hey, how are you?
I am unfortunately sick, so forgive me if I sound a little gross during this episode, if there is any coughing or sneezing. Sorry, I apologize to Christian and the audience. But I do have the flu, and I am home sick from work, so if any of my coworkers are listening and they're like, what the heck, you are not at work, sorry guys, economics cannot wait, but sorry, your computers can wait, though there are other technicians. Hi Andrew, hi Nate, hope you're listening to the podcast. Anyway, so this episode we are going to talk about price controls, because we heard out there that there are some people who actually want to learn some more about economics, so me and Christian have decided that we are going to give you guys what you need, because that's what we do in the free market. We hear what you guys want, and we give you what you need, because that's what the free market does. And what we're going to do in between shows, we are going to, I guess, this one, me and Christian, we were just discussing what we would talk about, and if you guys, we'll give you the information on how you can get a hold of us. If you have any questions of what you want to hear in economics, what you want us to discuss, or if you want to get on the show and discuss things and give us subjects to talk about. But today we're going to talk about price controls. And first off, in order to do that, I'm going to ask you, Christian, the question of what exactly are price controls in economics?
So what we know about prices is when suppliers and people who consume these products, the consumers, get together, they each, however they order within their utility, the goods that they want to buy or the goods that they want to sell and what they want in return, and they exchange. A price is something that the market selects to where they can capture the most amount of people with that subjective valuation, exchange their products for a profit. So prices are basically where buyers and sellers meet and agree on something. And it's very important that these prices are not tampered with. The reason that they should not be tampered with is that it can change the amount of goods that are available. It could lead to shortages. It could lead to even surpluses. And the point of this episode today is just to take a quick run through about, you know, what are some price controls? What are the kinds of price controls? And what kind of effects they can have on an economy at large? And why suppliers and consumers need freedom and they need correct information when making these valuations on what to buy and what not to buy to ultimately continue improving on a sustainable economy.
Oh, wait, you said so wait a minute. We shouldn't have price controls?
No, we shouldn't have price controls. Are you crazy?
Why not?
When I say we shouldn't have price controls, it's not necessarily where, oh, you know, the supplier thinks he can sell the good for $10, so therefore he shouldn't control the price on it. Well, in reality, he doesn't really control the price on it. He can put a best guess on it, but the consumer better buy the product or he's going to lose some money. So he can try to guess where he thinks a sale can happen. So in that sense, I guess he is controlling prices, or, you know, however much he bid for the products that go into the final product might have some kind of effect on what he thinks he can sell it for. But ultimately, if he's wrong that consumers won't buy what he sells at that price, it's the supplier or the entrepreneur who takes it. You know, he's got to eat the bullet, bite the bullet, and then eat it. We get the worst of both worlds there.
But I thought this was part of the capitalist scheme. The capitalist wants to make a profit, right?
Yes, the capitalist wants to make a profit, but ultimately he can only make a product if he successfully guesses what consumers want. And how do we know what consumers want? Well, if consumers buy your product, it means they wanted your product. If they don't buy your product at a certain price, it means they don't want that product at that price at that time. So in order for the capitalist to just make a profit, he's got to provide what consumers want. He can't just say, I'm going to make a profit, and then he makes a profit. That's some kind of fallacy that especially a lot of people on the left think just happens out of thin air, you know? Like these greedy CEOs and companies, they just make so much money and they don't even have to do anything. It just appears out of nowhere. But it's not McDonald's that makes money appear out of nowhere. That's the that'd be the central bank. But that's a topic for another time.
Yes. Oh, which reminds me, at another time we probably should have a podcast on that. I'm going to take a break out of price controls for just a second because I just unwittingly brought up another subject that I brought up on my Facebook that I started to bring up to people. Now, before I got into studying economics, and probably most people didn't even know this, and I started looking around. I even pulled out my handy dandy and physical dictionary at some point and looked up the word capitalism. And then I wondered if the definition was similar when I looked it up online, because some people don't actually have physical books anymore, and noticed that the term capitalism wasn't looked up very often even online. When you went to Merriam-Webster dictionary online, found out the term capitalism, the popularity of it being looked up was top 1%. I noticed, I was like, okay, maybe a lot of people looked up top 1% of lookups. The actual definition is a way of organizing an economy so that the things that are used to make and transport products, such as land, oil, factories, ships, etc., are owned by individual people and companies rather than by the government. Which means, America, we are not a capitalist society. Thank you. Just have to point that one out real quick. Anyway, back to price controls.
So, I want to address, I think that's really good for you to point out. We're not a completely capitalist society. We're not a laissez-faire capitalist society. It wasn't laissez-faire capitalism that caused the recession. It wasn't deregulation. It wasn't getting rid of Glass-Steagall. And it wasn't laissez-faire capitalism that got rid or created the Great Depression, as some people would have you say that they're historically wrong. And we're actually going to go into that a little bit, why. And I tell you what, it has something to do with government or government-sponsored cronyism and price controls.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to get into that, price controls are not something capitalist. It's not something from the free market. In order for a price control to come into effect, it has to be supported by a government or an entity where they have the final say, and if you don't agree with them, they point a gun at you, or they throw you in jail, or they take your property. That is not the private ownership or direction of resources. That is someone telling you, if you don't direct the resources in the ways that we allow you to direct your resources, then we're going to punish you. And if that can be said, are you really the owner of your own property, or if you are, is someone infringing on your ownership of that property? And that kind of gets into, you know, some people think that the Nazis liked the free market. Well, the Nazis hated the free market. The Nazis called themselves National Socialists. Their economy was driven around central planning and intense regulation. And when the government tells you who you can hire, what you can produce, what price it has to be produced at, and safety standards you have to abide by, you're not necessarily a free market system or a capitalist system. Now, is it fair to say we are more capitalist than other places throughout history? I would say, well, yeah, we still have a lot of freedom to do what we want with our resources. We are definitely more capitalist than a lot of other places. But the point is, if we want to become more capitalist, that is how we grow an economy. When we want to get rid of regulations, we want to become more capitalist. Who are the top two free market, or the place with the most economic freedom in the world today? It's Hong Kong and Singapore. You know, what's their poverty rate? What's their unemployment rate? Those places are doing great. Why? Because they allow their people to have a high degree of economic freedom, private property and planning. And even if you look at China, a communist country for the last 50 years, as soon as they loosen up their regulations and their price controls and their ability for people to plan their own lives, their economy took off, you know, in their special economic zones. But does that mean that they're capitalists now? No, they've become more capitalist. It's not a light switch, it's a dial. And the further you turn the dial in favor of capitalism, the more prosperity you can expect to have.
And a lot of the problem with that people have with capitalism, not just, you know, they just want to control a lot of aspects of it, I think is because they're scared of too much profit. A lot of things I've been studying and, of course, run into, you know, especially if you check out, you know, Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, talks about there's a term for profiteering, but you never see the lossier or whatever. You don't see a term for that. You always see profiteering, that people have an issue with that. Well, I mean, when it comes, it's just not, when a capitalist, they have, there's aspects when, you know, you get the interest, you have to pay, basically, you have to pay for your land rent, you have to pay for your capital goods, you have to pay your laborers, and then only after you pay that, then you have to, then from that is what you have to then half profit. It's not like whatever they make, all the, the capitalists are like, oh, now I have the money, I have all the money, and I'm gonna take and do whatever from it. They have to have all these three aspects that they have to pay into first in order to make future profit. They have to put into these three aspects first. So it's not like they're, when Marx is talking about, oh man, these workers, the laborers are being exploited. No, the workers are not being exploited, guys. They're talking about, the laborers are not getting all the money. Sorry guys, some of this money has to go into the capital goods. Like, you're missing some of the aspects in actually making capital goods. And I guess, this is where podcasts like this come into being handy, because we're missing all the steps in the economic process, and I think that's important to understand. And a lot of people are getting away with, using emotion against people because they don't have the knowledge to understand capitalism, and it's not just a system of evil profiting, and it needs to be controlled.
That's true. And you bring up a good point about the structure of production, wherein the worker or the labor, they're actually paid before the good is sold. They take on no risk. Now, being there, they do take on the risk, and hopefully their place of labor is able to sustain itself so that it can allow it to pay them more and that customers buy the products that they create. But the deal is, the entrepreneur must come up with the capital and the resources to pay workers before the good is sold. The capitalist doesn't receive profit first and then invest in the good or service. The capitalist has to first create the good or service, or arrange the resources so that he can produce the good or service. And to do that, sometimes he needs to take risks. He needs to take out loans. He needs to acquire capital. He needs to do that and pay the money that he just borrowed to all these people to sustain the structure of production until it's time to sell the products. After that, the capitalist then takes a profit, pays off some of his loan that he started with, invest more of it in the capital, invest more of it in better ways of the structure of production, or continue the structure of production so it can keep repeating the structure of profit. The capitalist receives his profit last. If the capitalist wants to cash out immediately, then well, yeah, he could just take it all and put it in his pocket. But if he wants to sustain anything, he's got to take the money he makes from profit and then reinvest it in his company, which means paying laborers for goods that haven't been sold yet that are still being produced, and then sell them later for a profit. So it's really the worker that's coming out ahead here. The worker gets to go and get a guaranteed wage, and a guaranteed hourly wage or a salary or something like that before even the product is sold. So it's really the capitalist or the entrepreneur who takes it upon himself, all the risk. And the people who think workers are being treated unfairly, it just blows my mind. There's just a lack of knowledge.
Yeah, and you also brought up a term that now Mises says, how do you spot an entrepreneur is the person who will also take the losses, and that's an important thing in capitalism, is an entrepreneur is going to take the loss because, of course, in an economy, if an economy is growing, of course the profit is going to be more than the loss. And an entrepreneur, if they make a mistake, there's going to be losses if they're not going, if they make a mistake in determining how much a product is going to be in the price and all of that sort of thing, they're going to take a loss. And taking losses is what pretty much should happen in a free market and determines, hey, if consumers decide, this is not a product they want anymore, they should be allowed in a free market because, what's the purpose of continuing to produce the same shoes over and over again and say, hey, let's just produce a crap ton of shoes, for an eternity. And consumers are like, why do we need this m amount of shoes? And just continue, because the more you produce this, then that takes away from the ability to put in, capital goods into something else. It's allowing the consumers, the capitalism allows the consumers to be the boss of the market. And that's what capitalism is. And people are starting to get confused by that. They need to realize capitalism allows the consumer to run the market. The consumer is the boss, basically, and the capitalist, the entrepreneur, is pretty much being run by the consumer, because if the consumers don't want this product, they'll say, you know what, I'm taking my money and my time somewhere else. And the capitalist is like, oh crap, the consumers do not want this product. What do I do? They're gonna go somewhere else. They're gonna invest their money in something else. What do I do? And they're gonna go out of business, or they have to change things.
Yeah, so it just gets to me how people, you know, people support Bernie Sanders and his democratic socialism, economy by the people. Well, when the people decide what they want voluntarily and choose to pay for something, and an entire market of people directs the production process, there you have capitalism, where you have one person or one group of people deciding what other people should produce by threat of force. There you have socialism. So, I mean, there's no more by the people system than the free market and capitalism and laissez-faire in the absence of price controls. So getting back to price controls, Kim, did you have some questions beyond what is a price control, or maybe some examples of the different kinds?
Yes. Excuse me, sorry. Now let's talk about some instances of price controls. Like, I was looking up some, like, say, maybe price controls like rent control. Have you seen situations like where they've tried to use price controls that have gone awry in situations that have really been detrimental?
Yeah, and actually, you know, I was kind of young, not really into economics at this point, but in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit, one of the problems they had was there was a shortage of water. Now, one of the reasons they had a shortage of water, and my first economics teacher kind of pointed this out, was because some companies would like to come in and sell their bottled water, we're not allowed to sell bottled water at an increased price during the crisis after the hurricane hit. And the reasoning was that these people wanted water so much, and fresh water and drinkable water, that they were willing to pay more for it. What you need to do is you need to let that happen, because what that happens is, in pursuit of these large profits, other companies who will seek those profits and come in. And so there's multiple competing sellers, and that would drive the price back down, and you wouldn't have a shortage of water. Instead, when you have price controls and you want to keep the price of goods low in this case because it's unfair or immoral to charge more for such a necessity, you know, then you have people just grabbing bottles of water, drinking half of it and pouring the rest on their head, you know, and people going thirsty. You don't make the water free to pour over your head. Make them pay for that. You know, when prices go down, if people can get a hold of that resource, they want to use the next resource for their next marginal benefit. So wherein, if you raise the price on the water, people are able to purchase the water and use it because it's expensive to their most important use, which would be drinking it, instead of three or four people getting in line first, grabbing a bunch of water and dumping it on their heads, which might be their third or fourth use for the marginal utility of the water, and there's other people left out. We can also look at New Year's Eve, the rant that the leftists in New York had against Uber, because Uber raised their price on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Because people were drunk and needed rides home. Well, you want to make sure you get a cab on New Year's Eve, where a lot of people are drinking and cabs are in high demand, you're going to pay a higher price. Think about Black Friday. Now, this is the example my economics teacher used that really hits home. Say Black Friday, the new PlayStation comes out. We'll call this PlayStation 5 because there's already a PlayStation 4. People want it. People want a lot of it. And the government says it is immoral for you to charge a higher price just because people want it more. You are profiteering and taking advantage of what people want, and you're a greedy capitalist, and we're going to punish you. You know what? We're going to set a law that says you cannot charge a high price because of this. So if you hold the price down, what happens is more people rush in to buy the good at a lower price than what would normally be available, and there will be a shortage of PlayStations. When you let the market determine prices, and a high initial price is set on a good, companies that seek the profit and they seek the price on this good because they think they can sell it for that, lots of people are going to buy that in order to resell. If more people end up buying that good in order to resell, or if there are more suppliers in the market, that drives the price right down. And it satisfies the most amount of people who are willing to use those resources for where they are most fit.
Yeah.
So that's an example of a price control that causes a shortage of goods.
And I thought this Uber one was really interesting. I'm glad you brought up something that was current. And this is what I love about the free market, is because when, of course, we went off on that one and everybody was on the side of, you know, trying to argue everything. And I'm like, this also allows, because I'm a person who's all about, you know, not driving. And I, of course, don't have too many options other than walking or using the bus, because that's also another option. If you do not want to use Uber because you think these prices suddenly got really huge, you can also use the bus. So you have plenty of options.
You could use the bus, but what's really, I think it's really funny that these people are protesting Uber for raising the price on in an instance where there's high demand at a you know on a kind of a special occasion on a holiday. But yet the reason Uber exists there is because there's value in providing more for a market to drive prices down. If they're really upset about high cab prices, they should welcome Uber into their market and protest the taxi cab companies that pay for a monopoly on their medallions. You know, why don't they protest high prices year round on them? It's just because they buy into the talking points and the idea that Uber is bad and they're driving out the taxi companies. Well, you know what? Gerald R. Ford drove to death the horse and buggy whip manufacturers. So competition and when businesses go out of business because they can't provide what workers want, that's a good thing. That's the market evolving and purging itself and releasing resources, either capital or labor or land, in order to be used for the next best marginal thing that people want, because what previously people wanted can now be provided to more people more efficiently.
Yeah, very true. You know, and it's just, it also, the short-sightedness of people, you know, it just, they start protesting just the wrong things, and then, you know, they just don't see the whole thing. It's like, you know, well, why was Uber created? Let's start to look outside and see the big picture of why Uber was created, and why would we be protesting this price? Why was Uber created? And then they start looking at the taxi services and go, wait a minute.
Oh, Kim, let's ask this question. Why do these people who hate Uber so much, why are they calling on Uber and looking them up to get a ride in the first place? Is it maybe because some kind of price control on taxis allowed there to be no taxis that you could get at a certain time? Were the taxis all being used up because prices were being held down? I don't know. But because the prices were high enough and Uber was allowed to raise their prices because they can, there's at least a car there somewhere that's willing, as long as you're willing to pay the price. You know, there is a car there waiting on you. And that's the difference. In capitalist countries, bread waits on you. In socialist countries, you wait on bread.
Yeah, very true. Or, you know, you had awesome friends like me who were on Facebook like, if you are drunk as a mofo, please call me at any hour. Boom. I love my friends. But please don't use them.
Yeah.
Like they're Uber. But... and then yell at them because, you know, maybe, you know, they're like, oh my god, their car's sick. And I protest that. But, you know, that's beside the point. But, you know, you bring up a good point. You know, it's just, you know, price controls, like, just lead us to these situations that we're in. And, like, you see a free market thing like Uber come in. And then we're, like, in a situation where you're like, well, guys, don't you see this is, like, price controls is what got us into a situation like the taxi service. And this is why, like, you know, we have to have, like, such a radical thing happen. And it's like, don't you see the price controls all around you? And people complain about these sorts of things, and they don't even know, like, all of these businesses around are price controlled, and then they complain all over the place about how expensive things are. I'm like, you know, you're not seeing the price controlled things all around it. And then, you know, you try to explain free market to them, and they balk at that. And then I'm like, you know, it's just the unfortunate ignorance of things is the problem. And I'm not trying to bash people by saying the ignorance of things. You know, not everybody is blindly ignorant to things. It's just that not everybody understands.
I mean, you could even apply the price control as in keeping the price down. It affects education, too. I mean, look at public education. Public education is basically free. All you have to do is go to school and someone else pays the taxes. Whereas if you wanted to get into a better or more prestigious private school, the prices are more expensive. Well, why is that? Well, the people who are finally able to say, hey, I don't want private school, they want private school and they don't want public school, they're able to go to a public school because private schools are able to raise their prices so high because they don't have to compete with as many people in the market. So the public school machine is kind of crowding out the middle ground, allowing private schools to charge ridiculous prices for them. From the other end of the spectrum, would you believe that there are more price controls to keep prices high than there are to keep them low? And can you believe that there's any kind of moral argument to be made for that?
Well, geez. I don't know.
Everyone knows what tariff is?
Explain.
So a tariff is a price on an imported good. And here the argument is that if we don't put tariffs on imported goods, these cheap people in foreign countries will sell their products super cheap in the United States and drive domestic producers out of business. For some reason, this is a bad thing. This has been a price control to keep prices high. It also exists in places like the minimum wage, you know, keeping the price of unskilled labor artificially high. And also, it was tried during the Great Depression by Hoover and FDR to keep the price of crops high, because apparently if you just give the farmers more money, or if you pay the farmers more money not to make anything, supposedly that helps the economy. But I thought the job of a farmer was to make things that people could eat, but FDR would disagree with me.
Yeah.
So the common thread in all these price controls to keep prices high, where if you look at a price control to artificially keep prices low, it causes a shortage. Well, a price control that keeps prices high or puts a very high floor on prices causes there to be an unused surplus. So in the case of the Great Depression, if we say, you know, farmers cannot charge less than X for their corn, farmers think that they can sell a lot of corn, so they produce a lot of corn. Now, in a free market, if you produce a lot of corn because you seek the high profits, the supply of the corn will drive the price down because there's more of it. However, when that's not allowed to work, you get kind of things like subsidies where, you know, there's allowed to be a high price for corn, but we're going to pay you not to produce so much corn. You know, we're going to pay the best farmers not to produce crops. And if there are excess crops, we're not going to donate them to other countries. We're just going to burn them.
Ugh, what a waste.
We're going to... This is historical fact. When you get into price controls to keep prices high, say, on a tariff, Frederick Bastiat tears this apart in the Candlemaker's Petition, where basically, if someone in another country can make what someone makes in your country and can make it cheaper, this doesn't necessarily hurt your domestic economy. What happens is you're saving money by using the product that comes from the other country much cheaper, and you're saving that money to enable in order to reach some kind of production that you weren't possibly able to attain. Because now that you've been able to receive that resource to apply it to a higher utility product that you wanted, the savings allow you to produce the next marginal thing, whether that be another import. And it also frees up the resources of people in your country that were making that thing to make something else. You know, the reason we have massage therapists and we have the NFL, you know, corporate subsidies aside, and we have all this entertainment going on is because we have all this cheap stuff that we're able to pay for other things that's more expensive, more luxury goods to make our lives more comfortable and in order to pay for this leisure time. But Bastiat kind of kills this in the Candlemaker's Petition when he says, you guys should have probably read this before. It was from the perspective, it was a satire, it was from the perspective of the Candlemakers. And the Candlemakers wanted to petition the government to make everyone close the windows on all their houses, shut the doors, and light all their candles, because it wasn't fair that during the day that they had to compete with the sun, and the sun made sunlight free, and that was bad for the economy. And it's a hilarious article. It gets right to the heart of the matter. Look, price controls keep prices high. That doesn't help your economy. It hurts it. What it does is it takes away the potential savings to invest in things that you haven't seen yet. You know, you see the workers who are receiving artificially high prices. What you don't see is the lost production that outpaces the supposed gain in their wages. Where, yeah, maybe their wages go up, but they can't buy as many things now because things are so much more expensive. It's a nominal trick. And the third one of the price control keeping prices high, we have the example of the minimum wage. And what happens is, you know, a lot of economists will say, well, if we increase the minimum wage, there's really no empirical evidence to say that it causes lots of job loss. Well, it may not cause lots of job loss in 6 months, but once it sets in and entrepreneurs realize that they need to change some things, fire some workers, get some more productivity out of these workers, or automate, that's when you see the job loss. So economists who want to draw the lines at stopping the research at certain times, you can make the data say whatever you want. But in reality, youth, teen unemployment, and skilled labor, whenever you increase the minimum wage, spikes sharply, and then it goes back down. Well, why does it go back down? Now, the reasons here are twofold. And we still exist in a relatively capitalist economy, so productivity outpacing inflation or outpacing wages is actually something to be celebrated. It means your dollar goes a lot farther. But there's the thing that has to do with inflation. Now, why, when you raise the minimum wage of unskilled labor, does it come back down? do employers come to their senses and decide to be more altruistic after being, you know, so emotional at first and hiring or firing workers? Well, no. It's just because of inflation. Excuse me. The static price of those of the labor, say the $7.25, as inflation takes hold, the real cost of that as a business eventually climbs down. So that's when you see unemployment among the youth and unskilled workers start to decline. Is because they become relatively cheaper because it becomes cheaper because the inflation basically makes the real minimum wage fall until it's raised again. Now, the answer here is to get rid of the minimum wage and let the market determine prices on its own. That's not, people aren't going to be paid slave wages and working in a factory. That's just kind of stupid because they have other alternatives they can go to. You know, when people say, oh, it's not fair that you pay for a product that came from China and sweatshop labor. Well, that, to the person in China, they want to continue producing that because if you don't buy what they produce, they have to go back to farming on a rice paddy for 16 hours a day. You know, I'd say sitting in a factory for 12 where it might be air conditioned and you can, are guaranteed kind of a wage before the, you know, like the entrepreneur said, before they actually have to sell the good, they can go back, they can buy more goods, they can buy more goods from your country. The more savings and the more money that people in other countries are able to produce, the more things you are also able to produce in your country and the greater amount of things that you guys can trade for each other. So there we have price floors. Keeping prices too low creates a surplus of unused resources, whether that's unused crops, unused savings that are never allowed to come into place when it comes to imports and exports, or you have unused labor. You have people collecting unemployment because it's illegal to hire them.
And then you, like, even worse, not even just the teens, you know, we always mention teens that get cut out in the minimum wage thing. You get unskilled workers who aren't even teens. Maybe you get middle-aged people, people in their 40s that maybe didn't get, you know, they got in this and they didn't even get a chance to go to college. Maybe they just didn't get, you know, they're stuck maybe at a McDonald's somewhere. And they're just stuck and they're like, oh, well, where the hell do I go now? You know, they're unskilled workers. Where are they going to go in this whole situation?
Like, and you know, the funny thing is about the minimum wage, it only affects such a small portion of the population is actually making the minimum wage that getting rid of the minimum wage, you know, it wouldn't hurt those people. It actually helped more people in that percentage of the population that it works. So the people making a big deal about, now if you start making it a fight for $15 of the minimum wage, you know, if we look, if we were to look at the wages of people in America on kind of a bell curve, you'd see very, very few people at the low end and very, very few people at the high end. But what you would see is an exponential growth and kind of a shrinkage as it goes on. You know, a normal distribution, there's, what, like 90% of the people in the middle bracket. If you were to raise the minimum wage like they want to $15 an hour, you're not just helping the 725 people or hurting the 725 people. You're encompassing the 8, the 9, the 10, the 11, the 12, and the $15. So as you increase a minimum wage dollar by dollar, you're not linearly affecting those people. You're exponentially affecting the price of those people's labor. You know, as much as capitalists and businesses want to make a profit, if they're in a competitive market with someone else, they want to be able to make their product more efficient and cost-effective than their competitor. And if you don't let the people who need to be cost-effective with their labor be cost-effective, you're setting them up for unemployment or government dependence. So, I mean, there's an argument to be made that maybe they want this kind of thing.
And also to make a point, because you know I'm notorious for this, and I love my dictionary. The definition of slave is someone who is legally owned by another person and is forced to work for that person without pay. So slave wage is an oxymoron. There's no such thing as slave wage because you don't get paid.
Yeah, slave wage is an oxymoron. It's kind of like a smart socialist.
Oh, so true. Somebody should look into the history of socialism. It's not pretty. And when people is like, oh, you know, we should try different forms of socialism. They've been trying different forms of socialism since the USSR, and it's just not has worked every single time. So let's stop trying that.
And you know what was the, you know, socialism was kind of a fringe movement until World War One.
Yeah, true.
Now, socialism began to pick up, and more government central planning came in with the ideas of John Maynard Keynes. that was kind of picked up from where is the one instance where price control is most abundant, and that's with our money. And that happened in 1913 with the Federal Reserve. So when people say we're not a socialist country, call bullcrap on them, because of course we're a socialist country. And the worst kind of price control that we could ever impose is a price on the interest rate. Because if you put a price on the price of a cell phone, or a price control, or the price of cars, or the price of doing something, you know, making some product have higher safety standards, that might affect that industry and slowly affect surrounding industries that they consume from. But if you put a price on money that artificially keeps interest rates low, that's going to affect everything, because the financial system is kind of the veins through which money flows, and that is the one instance where it is most important for the free market to take hold, so that people can direct their savings to where they are most efficient, not direct their savings to where the government would like it to be artificially most efficient, because it makes people spend more today because they don't like the fact that people save their seed crop. So what's dangerous, you know, with the fact of the PlayStation or the crops, you know, keeping prices high or low, making shortages and surpluses, what makes price controls and the monetary system so deadly is that you can hide it. And you can hide it with inflation because everyone can see when there's not enough PlayStations on the shelf. Or in Venezuela's case, when there's not enough toilet paper on the shelf. Or in the Soviet Union's case, there's not enough bread in the aisles. Or, you know, you can see it when there are too many unemployed people. However, if you're going to put a – you can't see when you artificially lower interest rates that the money's not there, because the money appears there because the Federal Reserve and the fractional reserve banking system can just print money out of thin air.
That's my favorite.
They just add a few zeros in your bank account. They lower reserve requirements, and the reserves that were already there are exponentially loaned on top of. So you see it on the paycheck. You see the money's there. The Federal Reserve says, okay, so, well, this is my trust that the money must be there. But what happens is when people – if you're a farmer and you harvest, part of your harvest goes to planting the next year. Now, if you become more efficient, you receive more to sell at the market, but you still want a seed crop to plant in the next year. You want to maintain your structure. You want to maintain your business. If you become more efficient, then you can sell more of your corn at the market, and you can buy more things for yourself and whatnot. So what happens is when you hide the shortage of money by printing more money, what people are doing is they're consuming their seed crop. They're eating what they're supposed to plant the next year because they think that they've reached an area where they've become so efficient and they're making all these profits, when in reality it's just inflation that hasn't hit the rest of the economy yet. And that's what makes your business look so profitable. So of course you look more profitable. You think you can do more things if you're spending your savings, where normally, you know, if you save money, you're saving it for the future. You have to cut back your consumption. Mm-hmm. But if you can consume the same amount and then consume a little more because the money you're supposed to be saving or the corn you're supposed to be planting later, you don't plant it, you're setting yourself up for doom in the long term. This happened during the Great Depression. It happened with the monetary expansion of the 1920s. It happened with the Great Recession that came in 08. Modern central bankers and pundits, government officials, they thought they had reached a new area of prosperity. And of course, they were happy to take the credit for the prosperity. You know, you have Bernanke saying there's no bubble, and then there's a bubble, and it pops.
Bernanke. Sorry. Go on. You were on a roll, and I interrupted. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. So, these people, they're... The fact that inflation and price controls on the money supply are so deadly is because you don't notice that you're consuming your seed crop. You think that it's there the whole time when you're just consuming your capital. And when you consume your capital and finally you have nothing to plant the next year, the resources are revealed to have been misallocated, put in lines of production that were not profitable and that people didn't want. Because interest rates need to be determined by people's time preferences. And not just by one person's time preference, but the time preferences of all individuals who put their money in the banks to save. Because if they'd rather spend money now, interest rates go up because the money's not in the bank. So the bank has to do something to attract the money into the bank. And also the bank has to tell something to people who want to borrow, hey, you better have something good that's going to produce in the short term because it's expensive to maintain your capital structure. Whereas if more people are saving money because they want things in the future, the bank's way of telling people there's more money is to say, hey, the interest rate is lower. Come borrow something, come take more risk. However, if people would rather consume money now, where interest rates might be 10% or 18% in some instances, and the Federal Reserve is either pushing rates low or keeping rates low when they would otherwise rise, what they're telling producers is take more risks, take more risks. And eventually, when those lines of production, the inflation flows into one area or the other, when the consumers reestablish that time preference, resources are revealed to have been not profitable, misallocations have been made. And the best thing you can do in that situation is let the Band-Aid rip itself off, let the depression bottom out, let prices fall to where they need to be. You know, a mistake that Hoover made and a mistake that FDR made was, one, tariffs, so Smoot-Hawley instituting price controls on imports. The second mistake they made was keeping the wages of people high, because supposedly the wages of the people need to stay high so that they can continue to buy stuff, which really doesn't make any sense. Well, why do you want to keep wages high, but you want to also keep the price of crops high by burning stuff? What you need to do is you need to let prices fall. You need to let people save their money so they can reestablish a sustainable capital structure. So when people say we're not a socialist country, it's a lie. Nearly every country in the world is a socialist country. However, the farther you move in the direction of freedom and laissez-faire capitalism, the more success you're going to find. And unfortunately, we have a very stealthy and a very ignored form of socialism, which is a price control on the money supply. And not only is that is about on one side, because money affects everything. We all use money to exchange for goods and services. It's also bad because you can hide the effect of the price control for a little while and then decide you want to blame something else like corporate greed. If you want to blame the greed of the bankers in 2008, you know, yeah, you can do it. But when someone was buying the crap that they were selling, can you really blame them for wanting to produce more crap? You know, when there's a market for bad loans that Fannie and Freddie were directed to buy, and that the Fed was wanting to buy. In the Great Depression, the Fed was subsidizing its own interest rate on acceptance loans and then buying them back. Herbert Hoover, who was supposedly a laissez-faire guy, said that it is important that because all bad foreign loans are still loans that benefit someone in the United States. These are guys that don't understand, and they think that they can just manage the economy and direct it where they want to go.
Yeah, we just really have to stop with the inflating the money and just all sorts. It's just like, you know, they always say it's just like, you know, pouring water into a soup and just trying to feed people this watered down soup all the time. Just after a while, people start to die because there ain't no nutrients in the soup. You know,
well, this, that you have to put in the soup, you have to get more of it. And then when it's revealed that there's not enough of that stuff to put in the soup, you realize you're just drinking water and you need to save and figure out how to get more of the stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, people just start to die, I mean, because they're just drinking water. There's no nutrients in the soup. So, you know, you can only inflate and have, you know, your money's just, you know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, we're about, like, 43 minutes in.
I want to quote that from Kim. When you have price controls, you know, people start to die. Yeah. That's the gist of it. the more extreme you get with it, of course, that's going to happen, you know. Someone asked Milton Friedman one time, you know, with all the recessions and business cycles and this and that that come with capitalist economies, how can you continually justify this? Of course, it was coming from a Marxist, and Milton Friedman hit him with, you can't possibly think that business cycles don't happen in other kinds of countries and other kind of economic systems. You know, sure, maybe, you know, and Friedman wasn't an Austrian, but when business cycles happen in capitalist countries, some people become unemployed and the price of goods fall and resources are reallocated. Unless you do what Hoover and FDR did and extend the Depression, or unless you do what the Fed did this time around and just kick the can down the road. What happens in a socialist country, their form of business cycles are food shortages, people dying, and prison camps. If there are business cycles, you like I said, rather be punched in the arm than punched in the face, give me a business cycle from a country that is not a communist or a socialist country. But and then, of course, we are still a socialist country, just we're moving away from that real fast. Hey, Kim, do you want to tell everyone about the meme that you shared in our private group chat?
Oh, wait a minute, which one was that one?
It was the one about the South American socialists.
Oh. Wait, now I have to. There was a lot of conversation that happened. So I gotta get back to it. Oh. Is it the top. Oh, yes, the top stories of 2015, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's see. Let me bring this gem out. It said the decline of socialism in the Americas. Venezuela, Brazil, but they have this nice little sign that says, "The communist idealism took our money, health, education, and our respect. Get out, PT, get out." What was that? I can't even barely read that. Anyway, and that's in Brazil, then Argentina, and then it says, "Well, along, only among those who've experienced it," and then under it, of course. It says, "We want Bernie." And of course, the "we want Bernie," that's us, the US. So Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina are giving us a nice little message saying they are recently the people who have shown us the decline in the Americas of socialism. And then on the bottom of the meme, where we over here in the US want Bernie. So let that be a message, everyone, that they have actually tried forms of socialism and it has failed.
Yeah, believe it or not, the Soviet Union collapsed.
So guys, we're not just being jerks, trying to usher in some sort of like era of capitalism or being like stuck up Austrian economist or anything, but these are actual places recently where it has actually destroyed like entire countries. Like, and people have constantly said, "Oh, we'll try a different form. They just didn't do it right, or their leaders didn't do it right." But how many forms of redistribution and putting this in the hands of, because one of the things, the problem is they keep wanting to say, "Let's just go and what we want to do is take all of the capital goods and everything and the funds and the profits and put them in the hands of the workers and all that." The problem is, like, all this misallocation and redistribution is cutting down the production, and all of a sudden, it's not working. It's starting to destroy these countries. Like, it's just destroying everything. And how many times do we have to go through this? Decades and decades of this kind of thing.
Well, Americans are always the last to get anything. I guess that's the joke around the world. Even Denmark, the prime minister said, "Shut up, Bernie. We're a capitalist economy." They may have a generous social welfare state, but that's only one facet of socialism, and it is not as devastating as price controls or trying to direct the structure of production. Generosity is not, or I guess you can't be generous with other people's money. It's not as destructive as a price control, like they attempted in the Soviet Union, or trying to, in Venezuela, betting on the price of oil not falling too low to subsidize their own social welfare programs.
You know what I think it is because it's like people have seen little vestiges, little inklings of socialism get into our system. So they're thinking, okay, we saw a little bit, let's let in more. And I'm like, no. Look at the history of socialism. Oh my goodness, don't let any more in.
Well, look at Sweden. The reason that they look so prosperous and happy at first is when you first impose these social welfare programs, they're consuming capital. They've built up a lot of savings because of their capitalist system. And then once they enact these programs, the savings start to dwindle. But for a while, it looks like you're living large. You're spending the inheritance money. You're not investing it. You're not trying to save it for the future. And that's why a lot of these Scandinavian countries are rolling back their social welfare programs.
Yeah, and then of course, one of the points that I know, like we have in our newborn libertarian group, the population of Denmark is around, what let's say, about 5.614 million people. That is not anywhere near the same amount of people that are in the U.S., guys. So if you're gonna try this whole redistribution thing, even with the 1% of the richest people, that is not going to work in our gigantic US. Like, for comparison, just in case you don't know what our population is, the population in the United States is about 320 million people. So compare that.
That's a lot of Swedens.
like in the US to compare. God. So, yeah. Try redistributing that wealth.
So we hit on all the price controls for this episode, giving people a good idea about what it is. There are books that I would recommend, Economics in One Lesson.
Yes, definitely. Very good book.
That'll tell you everything you need to know. If you want to learn more about the Great Depression and the price controls kind of opposed that way, check out America's Great Depression by Murray Rothbard. Those are the two main books I would recommend. Thomas Sowell's books, Basic Economics, easy stuff like that. Bastiat's The Candlemaker's Petition, that was really good, demonstrating why cheap imports are better and you shouldn't impose tariffs and price controls. That's probably the best thing I've seen, even though it was satire. So
Yeah,
expect
very
more
good.
of these kind of episodes, I think. Just little informational blurbs from me and Kim. We're planning on doing another roundtable with all our guests, with Tim and Dave and maybe Franco and Thurman, on our feminism episode. And that's one that I promised to shut up on because I know nothing about. But Kim's done a lot of research.
Oh yeah, because I remember saying that I didn't know anything. Oh yeah, I jumped all up into that, so there is no feminism ignorance over here, man. I'm all up in it.
Good. I think we can expect to have that out later this week. Maybe we can try to get everyone together.
Yes, yeah, either this week or next week, whenever we can get that in. Because I think Tim said he had a friend who is not a libertarian that can get on that one, so it'd probably be good to have somebody who isn't a libertarian that's in the discussion so we can get a fair range on that one.
And also, we had an, I think, Kim, we had an email from someone, from a listener, who said he would like to be on.
Yes, from I believe the band Darling Parade. Nate, yes. You guys can check out his band, like on Twitter. Pretty nice band. It's about like a very poppy, very rock. He recently posted a picture where his band were touting some guns and everything, and he had a couple negative posts, but mostly positive. And hey, Second Amendment there. So guys can check out the band. We're gonna have him on. He sounded like he is in for not being down with the socialism, so that'd be good. But yeah, it sounds like he would want to be on the show to discuss some topics, so it'd be good. But yeah, sounds like we'll have him on the show.
Sure. Let's have him on for the next episode we do. That's maybe just the two of us, and we can, you know, get a make it be kind of an intro for them, and then maybe have them as recurring guests.
Okay, let me down.
That'd be cool.
Down
So,
with that.
if you guys like what we have to say, if you'd like us to be better at saying it, if you hate us, tell us why. Send us emails. Actually, email Kim. She likes to read hate mail.
Oh yeah, I think I strive to be the hated one. Like I'm the one who always says the most obnoxious thing ever. I do it really well. I think on the Facebook chat and like the Jason Stapleton program, I think I come out to say the most obnoxious things ever. I like for everybody. I was like, if we get rid of that Kim chick, it'd be great. This podcast would be amazing.
Everybody loves you, Kim. You're the teacher's pet of the Jason Stapleton group. You
Yeah.
know it.
A special pet. Emphasis on special. And you can send that information to newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. You can hit us up on Twitter at Newborn Liberty. And also search out the Facebook group at Newborn Libertarian. And you know what would be appreciated if somebody can get us a new graphic because it'd be looking janky, this graphic. So somebody's got some skill out there. I'm not rich, but you know, you can I'll toss some bucks out your way. That's how the free market works. So
I'd
let me
like to
know.
second that.
Yeah.
It does be looking janky.
Oh, seriously, Jackie. But hey, man, I'm good at fixing computers, running sound, making podcasts, but I can't make a graphic for a thing, man. I'm terrible. So guys, don't be letting us look embarrassing over here, man. Send your skills this way and I'll throw some bucks out. So, all right, and let us know if you guys want in to us to talk about anything specific. It doesn't even have to be just about economics. Just anything you got, or if you have some criticisms, you want us to clarify things, you want to say good things, you want to say bad things, just send it our way. And you have anything else you want to say, Christian?
I'm good.
All right, then, well, until next time, this has been your host, Kim.
And Christian.
All right, bye.